probably puts that in a better key, but you get what you pay for, right? Okay. So welcome, everyone, to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'm Jonna Lou Johnstone, if you didn't know, the minister here. We strive to welcome everyone, no matter who you are, no matter where you're from, no matter who you love, no matter who is or isn't in your family. We invite you to bring your whole being and identity here, race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, age, abilities and disabilities, passions, curiosities, and doubts. Bring them all to this space and this time. You are welcome here. And I invite you to turn to one another and welcome those around you this morning. Our service today centers on Father's Day and our experiences of fathers and fatherhood. Are there any fathers here today? Well, yes, there are. Good. And Tom even comes out of the kitchen. I'm one. Is there anyone here who has a father? Okay. Well, now, we know that no two people, even those brought up in the same family, have the same experience of father or fatherhood. Some of you may not have fathers. Some may have lost fathers through separation or death. And some fathers may have lost children. Some may have difficult relationships with their fathers or with their children. And some may have amazing relationships with their fathers or their children, or both. And some of you may have special connections with men who have served as father figures, whether stepfathers, uncles, foster parents, mentors, teachers, bosses, or friends. And some of you may have been such figures. Father's Day, then, like Mother's Day, is complicated. We can't assume shared experience. Why then bother to celebrate it, especially in communal worship? Our task in gathering together in religious community is to uncover, recover, and discover the universals of human experience that can help guide us to live better lives. We look here for inspiration and for challenge. The only way we can touch the universals of human experience is through the particularities of our lives. And that's why we hear from different people about their particular experiences, and we'll have some of that today, hearing from different people. Now, part of the reason that family relations are complicated is that we're all shaped by the early relationships we had, good, bad, and indifferent. And what's more, for many of us, parenthood serves as one of the major identities. Not me, but I've heard that it shapes one of the major identities for many people. And we all need a chance to process these deep and significant relationships with parents and with children and with parent substitutes to find out how they fit into our lives, to celebrate them as we can, and to make peace with them when we must. Really, it's to seek to experience and give love in our lives. So today, if you have a dad, or a papa, or a father, or someone who acts like one, my hope for you is to discover or rediscover some connection, some way you're nurtured and loved. And if you are a dad, my hope is that you discover or rediscover the preciousness of your children in your life. If you grieve for your father, as I do, may you find comfort. If fathers haven't mattered to you, may you think of someone, of whatever gender or role, who does matter to you. On this day, may we all celebrate family in whatever way we are called to do so. And you are encouraged to review the announcements of the order of service, and I do hope that everyone will join us after the service in the ASOP room for coffee and conversation just down the hall. And I invite the Tononas forward for the chalice lighting.
I want you to picture a woman mothering her child. What do you picture? Somebody loving, nurturing, hugging, feeding, something like that. All right. What would you think if I talk about a man who fathered a child? Now, I cheated a little bit there. I changed the tense. I changed the pronouns, right? But it's not the same thing. We don't have the same sort of concept of fathering as we do for mothering. I mean, what is it to father a child besides spreading your seed, right? Or something like that. I mean, what is fathering? I can think about, is it playing catch? I can think about fathering a son. What's fathering a daughter? Standing with a shotgun when her boyfriend comes over, right? We don't have a good concept of fathering. Surprise. Parenting notions are gendered. We're not bound by words, but they make a difference. I hope we have a day which we have a concept of fathering that's as rich as our concepts of mothering, or we just talk about parenting, and we talk about the individual things that we do. We care for our children. We love them. We nurture them. We guide them. We teach them. We inspire them. We love them.
And a part of celebrating holidays like Father's Day and Mother's Day is celebrating the role of children in our lives. And with that in mind, I invite you to join in our opening hymn, number 338, I Seek the Spirit of a Child. Please stand as you're willing and able. One of the ways that we build community is to share what matters most deeply to us. If there's a deep care you bring with you this morning that needs release, now is the time to invite sympathy. If there's a profound joy, now is the time to share it. Please raise your hand and wait for the mic, and remember to speak directly into it so that you can be heard clearly. Are there joys and sorrows to share this morning? Really?
Hi, Anna Franklin. So when John Liu was talking about fathers and fathering, I couldn't help thinking about my older brother, because my older brother was more of a mom to his two kids than his wife was. He loved reading stories to them, pretending with them, and his wife just wasn't into that. And I'll just share one thing. He came home late from work one night and found his wife with their very small newborn, firstborn, singing Campbell's soup commercial to her because she didn't know any lullabies.
I just have a funny, I think kind of a funny story to relate about my husband as a father. He spent a great deal of time with both boys, and then educating them, maybe over-educating them, and then when Roger went to Israel for 6 years, and he was furious, just furious for 6 years. The last 2 years of his life, he kept saying, "We have fine sons." I felt like saying, "Well, what did you think?"
This is Ann Cowan. I just want to give special thanks to a father, but not mine. Yesterday, Scott Tonona came over and put in two window air conditioners in my house and has changed my life safe.
That's a joy.
Well, it is very appropriate, I think, on Father's Day to announce that Drew and Amber Venom had their twin babies, Veray and Vigo. The babies had to go to Topeka because they're a little bit early, and but they're doing well, and all are doing well, and we're very pleased with that. I'd also let you know that Grace McMillan is hospitalized. She should get out today. She was bit by a copperhead. Yeah. But she's doing pretty well. I saw her yesterday, too. So we hold all of these joys and sorrows in our hearts. It's a confusion of emotion, but that is how life is. And so I invite the children forward for a story. I think I can juggle it. That would be better. Okay. So, Father's Day. One of the things I know about families is that they're not all the same.
Because of the skin.
Well, that's part of it. Some families, my family has just two people in it. Me and my partner, Jane. Just two. That's all. Do you have many people in your family? Ish. Five. Four. Well, families can have different relationships and different connections. And some people are in more than one family. Or maybe there's one extra big extended family. Do you know what extended family means? Do you have aunts and uncles and cousins and grandmas and grandpas? Many. That's an extended family. All those people, they're not your immediate family, but they're your extended family. So this book helped me to think about different kinds of families. It's called One Family. One Family. So, one is one. Can one person be a family all by themselves?
No, that's a kid.
Well, that looks like a grown-up to me. One is one. One lamp, one clock, one book to share. Just one. Some people live all by themselves.
But look, two.
Oh, there are two over there, yeah. But here's two. One is two. One pair of shoes, or one team of horses, one family. Okay, so here we've got
three.
Yeah, one is three. One house of bears, one bowl of pears, and one family. Three people there.
Three.
That looks like it might be a mom and a dad and a child, right?
Four.
One is four. One ring of keys, one pile of pups, and one family. One, two, three, four. That looks like that might be a grandma and a grandpa who have two kids.
There's also four windows on that apartment.
Uh-huh. There are. There are. There are lots of fours in that.
Five.
One is five. One bunch of bananas and one hand of cards. That monkey's playing cards. And one family. So now, and not everybody necessarily looks alike. Yeah, not everybody necessarily looks alike in a family, too. Look, there's a redhead, and there's someone with brown hair and black hair.
Right there.
Yeah.
They all have the same skin.
Do they? They don't have all the same skin either. Yeah, one is six. One line of laundry, one butterfly's legs, and one family. Look, there's one, two, three, four, five, six. Is that a big family? Is that bigger than anybody's family here? Yeah, there's a baby in that family, and it looks like there's an older person in that family. So one is seven. Uh-huh. One bouquet of blooms, one flock of birds, and one family. Look, those must be little baby twins, right? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. There's a lot of people in that family.
They don't look the same.
They don't all look the same.
Hey, there's a dog, too.
Yeah, there's a dog, too. One is eight. One one box of crayons, one row of ducks, and one family. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. That
looks...
Yeah, and there's a dog, too. And that looks like Grandma and Grandpa may live with that family.
Grandpa, Grandma.
Uh-huh. One is nine. One flight of stairs.
I think there's 15
families. One collection of rocks and one family. Look, oh, one, two, three, four, five,
nine.
Six, seven, eight, nine. I almost didn't count the baby. That's a lot of people in a family.
That's the baby.
Now, one is 10. One batch of cookies, one shelf of books, one family, and there's 10 people there. That's a lot. One is one and everyone. One earth, one world, one family. Because if you go back far enough, we're all related, right? One family. Okay, that's our story for today.
And
the only sacrament of the free church. It is a symbol. I mean, it is something real. We're passing the plate for actual money, but it's also a symbol that we are the supporters of our church. It's the members who make the church happen. It's the members who make the fellowship live. So please give generously. Thank you.
So fatherhood has changed a bit since I was a child. Deborah Wood, who is the writer of our reading this morning, is a child development specialist, and she writes about the changing role of fathers. It's a little long, but I thought it was worthwhile. What a joy it is to see my son as a father. He's been at it a little over a year, but from the start, it was clear he was born to the role. Among his peer group are many new fathers who've thrown themselves headlong into what has been referred to as hands-on parenting. At my grandbaby's first birthday party were several dads holding, feeding, and playing with their infants and toddlers. One dad adroitly juggled the needs of his 3-year-old daughter and 1-year-old son, explaining mom had just come off the night shift at the hospital and was home sleeping, so he fearlessly took the 1-hour drive with the children, diaper bag, and expressed milk in tow. One of the earliest studies on the importance of fathers was conducted on Norwegian fishermen families between the years 1850 and 1920. At that time, and in that culture, the female role was daily nurturing, and the father's role was to provide material resources, even if it meant scant direct attention to the children. The study concluded that long absences indeed affected the well-being of children, mainly because of the mother's isolation for long stretches of time. Today's new dads have moved well beyond providing emotional and material support for the mother. A heartening sight is a man out in public snuggling an infant strapped to his chest or pushing a toddler in a stroller, and sometimes both, sometimes momless. Researchers concur that children whose fathers take an active role in caregiving in the early years leave lasting positive effects well beyond economic support. Compared to tots with less involved dads, young children are more patient, have better linguistic and cognitive capacities, in essence, more readiness for starting school and being successful with it. Differences show up even earlier and with more emotional security and confidence to explore their surroundings. Studies see a connection between the amount of involvement the father provides and the level of sociability and popularity the child has with peers throughout early childhood. Fathers' increased involvement in the raising of their children has paralleled many societal changes, foremost being the rise of mothers in the workplace. As many as 32% of preschoolers in the country are cared for by their fathers while their mothers are at work. And in less than a generation, the number of stay-at-home dads has tripled. The U.S. Census calculates as many as 20% of children under the age of 5 are primarily cared for by their fathers. And in homes where there's only one parent, 15% of these are men. As a group, they're gaining in numbers as well as rights and custody battles. And with evident proof that a father's care can equal a mother's, attorneys and judges are helping more single dads. Simple changes in language have accompanied behavioral changes. For example, "I've got the kids" has nearly replaced "I have to babysit." Add to the contemporary mix the 50% divorce rate, parents who live with their own parents, the acceptance of gay couples as parents, and single parenting by design. Dads, at least the ones I spoke with, expressed concern that their children get the best parenting possible while the supporting adults maximize their career possibilities. One aptly put it as a balancing act. What struck me was how much these dads thought of each parent's contributions on a case-by-case basis rather than the traditional model of fathers versus mothers roles. If the goal is to bring up healthy, well-adjusted children, how do we support both mothers and fathers? Policies and practices often limit dads' function to the archaic vision of solely the breadwinner, especially for low-income families. And in reality, mothers and fathers must co-parent to make the family unit function. We're not completely there. But when I see a 3-year-old hand daddy her juice box so she can use both hands to stack blocks, and He maneuvers his own cup so he can hold both drinks in one hand so the other is free to add blocks to the tower. I believe equal opportunity has become more of an expectation. So now I invite you to soak in the words and images and see where they take you. Our hymn is number 357, Bright Morning Stars. Please stand as you're able and willing. I hope that the music and pictures I shared a few minutes ago were not too sentimental. I confess that I am more likely to get sentimental in talking about Father's Day than Mother's Day. Maybe it's because my mother's so unsentimental. But sentimentality is not to be encouraged. Theologian Frederick Buechner writes that sentimentality is to look only at the emotion in it and at the emotion it stirs in us, rather than at the reality of it, which we are always tempted not to look at because reality, truth, and silence are all what we are not much good at and avoid when we can. Maybe my tendency towards sentimentality around fathers comes because my father died nearly 30 years ago. So the relationship with him that I have has moved from the realm of immediacy and reality to something else entirely, something I can easily distort and romanticize if I'm not careful. Or maybe my sentimentality comes because my father always seemed more of a comforter to me than my mother did. When I was 2 years old and in the hospital with pneumonia, only one of them could see me at a time. Navy hospitals were strict back then. And when my mother was leaving, and they had to leave me alone with the nurses most of the time, she reassured me by telling me when she would be back, and I looked at her in my full, sick, 2-year-old persona and declared, "Not you, Daddy." At least that's the story my mother tells. Either way, I can strive to bring my relationship with my father back down to earth to understand the reality of it and not only the emotion of it. I was a bit of a daddy's girl. Firstborn and the only daughter, I was named for him. Yes, he was John Johnstone. Sounds almost like a stutter, but... And though small for a Marine, he had the toughness, even if it didn't show on the surface. Instead, what showed was a relaxed manner, an ability and willingness to talk to anyone, and a curiosity that spurred his intellectual pursuits. Yes, intellectual. He was a historian in the Marine Corps. He had served in World War II in Korea, but in the time I was alive, he wrote books about battles and documented timelines and interpreted oral histories. Intellectual does not match the stereotype of Marines, but it did capture something of what my father was. He'd been adopted as a six-month-old baby after his mother died because his father could not care for all the children. His two families, his birth family and his adoptive family, could not have been more different. The birth family included 10 children, while he was the only child of his adoptive parents. He went from poverty to comfort with that adoption and likely lived only because his status improved, as he was a sickly child. Unusually for the 1920s, his was an open adoption, and he always knew where he came from. A picture of the siblings as young adults shows huge contrast. My father looks neat, sharp, preppy, if smaller than his brothers. The others, men and women, look worn, older than their young ages, and a little bedraggled and faded. Dad always knew he was fortunate. He said if he were a cat, he'd be dead. He'd had so many brushes with death. He was a man of his times. I remember him saying that women shouldn't be newscasters because their voices didn't have authority. That was in the days of Walter Cronkite, of course. Yet he spoke to me and to other children, too, as if we were people whose opinions counted and who could be trusted to make good choices. I thank my father for the sense of wonder, for the commitment to teaching and learning, for the embrace of the joy of living, and the value of every person one encounters in a day. No one was invisible to him. The clerk at the drugstore, the child in the stroller. And after nearly 30 years, I still miss him and suspect I always will. I've been lucky too, though. When I got involved with my partner, Jane, I got a new dad, at least informally. His name, too, is John, and like my dad, was born in 1921, and next week he'll turn 95. A plumber by trade, he, too, approaches life with optimism, humor, and an ability to talk with anyone. You saw him a couple times in the slideshow. He'll never replace my dad, but having him in my life reminds me that love is not a limited commodity, but can rise to meet more people than we might imagine. And that's a lesson in keeping with my father's legacy.
I've wanted to be a dad for as long as I could remember. Even when very young, it was up there with my earliest ambitions for time travel and superpowers. While the others never worked out, I did become a father, and it was just as transformative as everybody told me it would be. Life now revolved around logistical management in a way it never had before, making sure the baby was fed, cared for, and clean took up a great deal of time and time management that was different than the more spontaneous lifestyle we'd lived till that time. Something I never quite planned for, though, were the circumstances that made me the primary caregiver for my children. When Leah was born, we had every intention that I would eventually return to the government staffing career I'd put on hold so my wife could finish her doctorate. I'd started work in a 411 call center to get us the insurance that the university didn't provide to its graduate students at the time, and the union provided excellent coverage, giving us our best chance to go through the expense of having a child affordably. Our out-of-pocket expenses for Arthur's childbirth years later, with Ellie's professor-level insurance, were about 150 times higher, and that was with me as the one who delivered him in our living room. When Ellie did finish her doctorate, we moved several times, each time somewhat resetting my ability to find a career-level job. So I became the stay-at-home dad. I got better at housework, I spent a lot of time with my daughter, and I discovered that the system, while progress has been made, is still very subtly biased against stay-at-home dads. I really noticed it first when I took Leah to the park and found that the other mothers would circle the wagons and watch me suspiciously. Ellie, for a long time, wouldn't believe me. She'd never experienced such a phenomena, but one day she met us at the park when we were there beforehand and saw it firsthand and described it as a revelatory experience. When Leah started school, it continued, despite me being listed as the first contact person. First daycare, and then even here at elementary school, would always call her first as the mom. We eventually started tricking them, switching our numbers in their records, even though I remained a listed point of first contact. At various points, I've taken some fairly awful job to help our family make ends meet, and some of them have been marvelous and understanding, and some stared at me in stark incomprehension and even occasional argument when I would tell them that I would be the one leaving work for a sick child and not my wife. None of this is great suffering by any means, but it's made me keenly aware of how culture treats fatherhood, and I've started just keeping track of every time I see something like that. The idea that even being marginally involved and engaged with child rearing makes one some sort of paragon instead of normal. I live with a great deal of imposter syndrome and often feel like I'm flailing and faking my way through being a decent father. My wife frequently tries to make me feel better by sharing stories of fathers she hears about on the internet or people that she works with, of the wives who are grateful to their partners for very occasionally being willing to babysit their own children to give them some time to themselves, or castigate them for being almost entirely unwilling to change diapers. She means well, but I guess I'm enough of a pessimist to think that just because other dads are worse doesn't mean that I'm good enough. It does tell me, though, that our culture still has a notion of fatherhood based on a somewhat outdated paradigm. The arc of progress is on our side. I didn't have nearly as many problems bringing Arthur to the park as I did with Leah. But while I like to think, and we like to think, that our history will sweep our progressive ideals into their proper place, I think that history rather shows that only happens when people make it happen. I continue to try to muddle through as best I can and hold on to my own father's advice to try to be good and kind, because if nothing else, I would like my children to have that as a lesson.
When I hear Marty Robbins or a squeaky door on an old rusty Chevy pickup truck, I think about riding shotgun with Grandpa in his old truck as we ride around looking at the best concrete jobs in town. Of course, I had to step over a pile of tools on the floorboard, and then when seated could hardly see over the pile of papers that were piled high on the dash. I probably tried sticking my elbow out the window so I could be as cool as him. Oh, and there was the smell of Old Spice. When I make the first cut into a piece of wood and the oils and the dust are released, I think about sitting on the end of a board while my dad is cutting it to make a cabinet for Mom in the kitchen. I want to watch what he is doing, but I also really don't like sawdust in my eyes. We didn't have safety glasses back then. I have my very own measuring tape hooked on my belt and ready to use it at a moment's notice. Dad and Grandpa always said, "Measure twice and cut once." Of course, this meant that they measured twice and then I got to measure twice. When I smell cool, moist dirt or walk beside a small stream, I think about backpacking with Dad and Grandpa in the Smoky Mountains. I think about seeing the last few blooms of rhododendrons or the mountain laurel. I think about throwing our plastic food bag over a tree limb and suspending it so the bears wouldn't get to it before we did. I think about trying to outdo Grandpa by opening an orange in the middle of the woods after only eating dried fruit for a week. I also think about waking up in the morning and hearing dew falling off the trees onto the roof of the tent. When I hear an auto harp being played, I think about my dad playing his, or the mountain dulcimer that he put together from a kit. I think about the little wooden dancing man that bounces to the beat of one of Dad's records of Appalachian music that he picked up when he was in college. I think about running into my room to get my recorder so that I can play along. The most meaningful gifts that I can give to my kids are these kinds of experiences. All of the memories that I have with my dad and grandpas are doing the things that they love doing the most. That is why my kids nail scraps of wood together as I work on a project in the garage, why we listen to some of my favorite music, why I talk to them about projects that I'm proud of, why we go bird watching, even though we scare most of the birds away. My hope is that you weren't actually really listening to any of this, but that I triggered some memories in your mind of times that you spent with your dad and grandpa, and that you took a little trip of your own. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Matt and Jonathan. Tough acts to follow. I wrote some stuff out, and then this morning when I started writing in my journal, I came up with a whole nother paragraph because it would be easy to get the wrong impression from the material that I prepared. At John Alou's request, I've worked up some reflections on fatherhood. And the problem in doing so has turned out to be making any coherent piece out of my work. And this is probably because the fathering that I've received has been itself somewhat incoherent. And not being a father, I lack the synthesis of personal experience to advise anything I say here. So I guess I could be accused of being an imposter at this point also. But I've spent a lot of effort, both in private and with professional help, therapeutically meditating and analyzing on my experiences on the receiving end of fatherhood, but very little over the years on the good parts, because the good parts don't demand a lot of meditation. It's only overcoming adversity that takes a whole lot of effort. So if this comes out seeming a little jaundiced, please take that with a grain of salt, because I do. Because like any challenge, meeting the challenges of our childhood families, meeting those challenges carries rewards, like any other family, any other challenge. And while truly good parenting is often seamless and difficult to break down, it's only the bad stuff that, for me anyway, has ended up getting explicit attention. But, so, not being a father myself, I'm afraid that these reflections, such as they are, will be pretty one-sided. I've only had it coming, not going. But I'm blessed with multiple fathers. I had a birth father, Barry Buckles. I had a childhood father, Alan Bailey. And now I'm privileged to call Larry Weaver my dad. My birth father was, like my mother, a very young person of a family long known to my mother's family from the Catholic Church and from school. Largely because they were so young, it didn't work out. And that's probably saying enough, but he did get the job done because here I am. And I thank him for that. My vague toddler memories of Barry Buckles are both of the Kansas City Zoo on one hand and being bored and ignored on the other hand. By the age of 5, I was adopted by my stepfather, then stepfather, Alan Bailey. And if anybody here ever knew him, he was a hail fellow, well met. He had a gift for gab and a very eclectic set of talents. He worked in and enjoyed the arts very, very much, performing arts specifically, and He never hesitated to share any and all of it with me. I still feel like I'm in his presence every time I go to McCain Auditorium. I worked for him at McCain Auditorium on several occasions, and from him I've got my own eclectic set of competencies, aesthetic appreciations, and bits of Americana, such as the long, hot summer road trip vacation. I might as well have invented the phrase, "Are we there yet?" And I was, in fact, surprised to learn that I wasn't its sole practitioner. So while I never doubted his love for me or my mother, he taught child me a lot of very valuable lessons about adults and about life. Adults can be mercurial. They can be childish themselves. They can casually break the most important promises. And they can be tragically unreliable, grade school tragedy, at any rate. So I learned self-sufficiency and resilience and to ask very directly for what I needed from adults. I also learned how to cook. But he also rejoiced in teaching, which he did best by example. And that also meant that he wasn't always aware of what he was teaching at any given moment. One of his adulthood, in my adulthood, one of his paramours asked with what I took to be solemn significance, "What did your father teach you?" I think she wanted to learn more about the charming and worldly man with the oddly obscure psyche. And I took the question as diagnostic, a way to learn of him by his influence on others. And the spirit of genius must have visited in that moment, because it only took the moment for me to respond, "Patience." In the end, he also taught something I see more and more in people of a certain age, going through these days. How to deal with the role reversal between a parent and child that comes with age and infirmity. And now to the good part, if I can get through it. Now I get to claim Larry Weaver is my father. How cool is that? When you have Larry's attention, you know that he's focused on you. He fathers so deftly and did it to me, so adolescent me, so deftly that I didn't even know it was happening. And now it's really hard to parse out distinct reflections, because he never required the repeated meditation that other fathers, in my experience, have required. Larry was just always available. He was always interested and sympathetic, if that was called for. I'm speaking of him in the past tense, because this is what formed my opinions, not because he's not with us. He's not with us today because he's in Minnesota with my niece. But he always treated my concerns as important, whether they were or not. They were important to me. That was all that mattered. And he responded seriously, as though he were talking to an adult. And he could teach. Many times, both in person and on the telephone from distant cities, he was available to unmathematical me when homework seemed impossible. I could call him at any time, and he would be there. That was unique. I was the most important person in the world at that very moment. I was chagrined to still be doing this in college, but I wish I'd called more. Excuse me. Can't read my notes. I wish I'd called more. I should have called more, but it wasn't my habit to ask for a lot of help. Self-sufficiency had been learned early. One thing, though, is that he always let me make my own decisions, counseling and supporting very gently. He says he got this from his father, the late O.C. Weaver. O.C. always said, from the time a weaver is 4 years old, he makes his own decisions. Doubtless good parenting advice, but with Larry it showed the way for a conflict-less interaction, free of any imposed aspirations. I suppose the best fathers are those who encourage their children's development through the children's interest rather than some blueprint for how things are supposed to be. And actually, I was inspired by Scott's query to imagine, you know, an image of fathering. And so my closing image comes from my mom's recollections of childhood. My mom was the middle child. My grandparents were married shortly before World War II started. And so they were the progenitors of some baby boomers. They had nine children altogether. And so they were spread out over a fair amount of time, and they did not get up in the morning all at once. They didn't come thundering down in the morning for breakfast because they all had their own schedules. But they all needed breakfast. And my grandfather, Daddy Joe, we called him, would get up very early every morning to do some gardening and to do some this and that, but he ended up making breakfast for everybody. And so he would start making breakfast around 6-ish and continue until everybody had been fed. And my mother's recollection of him, and this image is apocryphal in my mind, I mean, I can see him in the kitchen in question, but I wasn't there for it, obviously. But her image of him was of a bird feeding its chicks as they came by. And for me, the image of fathering that comes to mind when Scott asked his question was that of a traditional male who worked all day every day and came home and worked another 2 hours in the garden after work, but was always there every morning, you know, plopping onto the plate whatever the child needed. So thank you very much.
We have a few minutes for further reflections and discussions, if there are any comments or thoughts. Do we have a... We've got some hands. Do we have a mic somewhere?
I'd like to say a word or two about the adult males in my life who are not my father. My father was a good father. He was an old father, in fact. But at any rate, I think about several of these men. One group is, I started working in my dad's filling station and tire stores when I was 12, and the men who worked there were very anxious to be sure that when my dad wasn't looking, I was getting proper supervision. And I'm indebted to several of them for things they taught me about what you do when the person who will be affected is not around to see what you do. That is, when you put his spare tire in the trunk, you make sure that it's holding air. You make sure that it's put away the way so it won't rattle and things of that sort. The other group are the men who are on the faculty in my junior high. I don't know, you know, what goes on in the minds of a 12-year-old boy, but it's a mess. I remember enough of that. And one year I taught 7th grade, and so I got to see it and relive my time as a 7th grader looking at it here. But for some reason, I thought going there, it was the thing to do was to be the baddest kid in school. And pretty soon I figured out that I was no competition for the real bad kids, and I turned around. But I never begrudged the teachers who continued to watch me carefully that I might go off on some bad. I just understood why they wanted to do that. One day in eighth grade math class, long after I had changed my ways, Bill Davis tapped my shoulder, and I turned around, and he handed me a note, and Ms. Graham looked up just at that time and said, Michael, bring me that note. Well, it was a dirty picture, and I knew that it was not a good idea to take it to her, and I refused, and she said, well, you go tell Mr. Baker, the principal. And so I went in to see him. Okay. He said, old father, what is it this time? And I explained. He said, well, let me see the note. And I can imagine him doing his best to be the principal saying, old father, you did the right thing. I'll straighten this out with Ms. Graham. Now, what I know about is these four or five men went to a table in the by the boiler, and sat around a table and shared their stories. And I know how that story must have played, and I can imagine those older men who were helpful and concerned about me recognizing that I was a work in progress probably never being able to look at me again without remembering just what I had done. Innocently.
My son, that many of you have met, is a chef now working in Little Rock, Arkansas. But he told me a story about a class he had taken when he was at the Culinary Institute in Chicago, where he studied, that sort of broke a stereotype about why men become chefs and cooks. The old stereotype was it was because their father cooked. In other words, it would have been because I prepared meals. My son would want to prepare meals. The study showed, in fact, it was not just fathers. It was fathers and mothers. The chefs tend to come from home. Male chefs tend to come from homes where both fathers and mothers prepare meals. And so I've sort of been thinking of that story, I've been hearing about fathers, that it takes fathers and mothers working together to prepare men to assume roles which sometimes might be assumed to be more feminine. But the father provides kind of a voice of approval for the son to pursue that. And my son would not be where he is today were he not a chef. Little footnote, it's wonderful having a chef in the family when we all get together.
Michaela Sievers. Some people have mentioned other, you know, older male role models to look up to. And many of you know Richard Pitts, and I was in his Wonder Workshop program for a handful of years. And I still kind of get a chuckle when I think of Richard introducing himself to my father as my black daddy.
Well, let's join together in singing then. Hymn number 409, Sleep My Child. Please stand as you're willing and able.
Thank you.
And now may the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, be in us and among us now and always.